Welcome to the Whole and Healthy Vibe podcast, a show to help you shift away from the diet and dogma towards a whole and healthy life.
We're your hosts, Laura and Kezia, health coaches, cake lovers, and body positive warriors. Let's get the show started.
Hi there, welcome to the podcast. It's Laura with you today. I'm going solo while I interview a good friend of mine, Laura Thomas, PhD. We've known each other for a good few months now, and she's a registered nutritionist who's really, really passionate about evidence-based nutrition. She blogs for the Huffington Post and is also the host of her very own wellness podcast, Don't Start My Game, which I totally recommend you check out. She's got lots and lots of qualifications around nutrition and health. So she's a fantastic person to talk to about a number of different subjects. In this episode, we get really, really deep about Laura's own journey with health and her relationship with food, why she decided to get involved in nutrition and the Health at Any Size movement, as well as intuitive eating, and why she's so passionate about promoting intuitive eating as a way of getting away from the diet mentality. So please do get comfy and tune in. This is a fantastic episode. Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Hi, Laura. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
No, thank you very much for joining us. I'm very excited to have you on. In case any of the listeners don't know who you are, can you quickly tell them a little bit about yourself?
My primary job is as a registered nutritionist, but that kind of encompasses a whole bunch of really varied projects that I'm working on. So I see clients one-on-one and help them with food and nutrition. I also run a podcast called Don't Salt My Game. Yes. And that's sort of talking with various different experts about all different types of health and wellness related subjects, but I really try and get people who are super experts in their field to come on. And I also write evidence-based nutrition blogs for the Huffington Post. And I teach intuitive eating online to a group of people, which is really exciting, and loads of other little projects that I can't really quite talk about yet, but they're all super exciting.
Yeah, I know. I hate that one.
I hate it when people say that, but I'm just like, oh, I'm going to say it anyway.
Well, here you see, you're being interviewed rather than being the interviewer, so it must be nice to be able to say, well, actually, it's a super secret project.
I know, I've kind of wanted to drop it into my podcast a couple of times, but I'm like, is that really sort of narcissistic of me to say that? It's not about me. But yeah, it's super weird actually being on the other end of the interview, rather than giving the interview.
So we've known each other now for a good few months, haven't we?
Yeah, actually, I've been following your blog for a couple of years. You probably maybe didn't know that, but fun. Yeah, known of your blog for a long time, and then we connected over my podcast, and so it was really nice for you to reach out to me.
No, and you're also a guest expert within the Balance Club, which is one of my projects that I run, and you've been a fantastic guest expert there. So I was really excited just to have you on the Whole and Healthy Life podcast just to talk a little bit about quite a few different topics actually that I'd really love to kind of get your take on for our listeners. But first of all, I wanted to ask you just some kind of little questions just to set us up. And first of all, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Oh, so super boring, super cliche, but it was porridge. I like to add flaxseed to it. I had some nut butter, some raspberries, a little splash of maple syrup, and some almond milk. I had a cup of green tea, but I've also actually recently been taking a probiotic in the morning, which is something that I was given to try out. So I've been trying that, and I'm going to say the jury's still out on that one, but I'm going to be writing a lot more about gut health soon, so watch out for that, and maybe I'll talk a little bit more about my experiences with probiotics.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. And that's not actually dissimilar to the breakfast that I had as well this morning.
I know, what big fat blogger cliche.
I know, we are. We certainly are. And then, and do you have any particular rituals that you have in the morning? Do you have like a particular morning routine or anything that you follow?
You know, for a while I was really good about getting up and doing just a 10-minute headspace meditation, maybe having some warm water and lemon. But I've been so busy and I've been so tired that I've been just letting myself have that extra half hour in bed and not myself up about it, but you know, I'm hoping to get back into that routine in the morning. But I think one thing that's quite important that we do in my house is my boyfriend and I will always sort of sit down and have 20 minutes, half an hour to have breakfast together and just sort of be calm in the morning before the craziness of our day. So mm-hmm. it's not a formal meditation, but it's really nice to, I think, just check in with each other in the morning before we go off and do our busy days.
Yeah, I think that's lovely. I think so often, like morning time's so hectic that you just don't really get that kind of pause. And especially doing that with other people who are in your household as well and your family, I think is really important. So that sounds like a lovely morning routine.
Yeah, we like it.
Yes. So kind of getting on to your profession and what it is that you do, I'd love to find out a bit more about what kind of, you know, what really inspired you to become a nutritionist. And you've also went through quite a lot of training. You've got a PhD. So what was the reasoning behind you taking it to that so far and really becoming an absolute expert in what it is that you know about?
I would never call myself an expert in that.
Seriously?
I feel like I know a lot about, or I know a little about a lot of different things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I guess my personality is that I'm really curious and I like to solve problems, and that's to me what research is all about. It's just, if you're a nosy person, then you're really suited to research, is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I'm a super expert in anything, but you know, I know a lot about lots of different, or I know a little about lots of different things. So in terms of my journey, actually I went to university to study biotechnology. I was always like a super biology nerd in school, like just a science nerd in general. And it was then that I kind of had a few lectures on nutrition just within the context of the course that I was doing, and it really sparked something in me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had always sort of struggled with my relationship with food and overeating and undereating at various different points growing up, and comfort eating and all that kind of stuff. So I think there must have been something in there that was like, oh, if I could just understand the science of nutrition, then I could figure out all these problems. And obviously that's not true. Yeah. It's almost as though the more you know about nutrition, the more messed up your relationship with food is. And I've seen this, you know, time and time again amongst nutrition students, dietetic students, colleagues, and people that I've talked to, friends that are in that community who've also really experienced, you know, some level of an unhealthy relationship with food.
Can I ask, what do you think, is it because nutrition is quite, I mean, from and I haven't got a formal nutrition qualification, but from the outside it seems to be quite a difficult area of science, because you tend to see things, or certainly it appears like that from outside, that contradict one another. Is that true from your perspective, or is that just something that we tend to get as the public kind of looking into this?
Yeah, I think it's an unbelievably complicated subject to study, because it's not just, you know, nutrition is not one discipline. Nutrition is made up of, you know, psychology, sociology, molecular and cell biology, physiology, public health, and all these other disciplines go together and make it. And they all these disciplines approach studying it in different ways through different lenses.
Mm-hmm.
But more often than not, what happens is that scientists they'll do a big epidemiological study. So they'll look for patterns in relationships between food and disease, or what a population is eating and disease outcomes. So for example, it could be like the Japanese diet. Okay, we know that people in Japan eat a lot of fish, they eat a lot of vegetables, they eat a lot of rice, but they have lower incidence of breast cancer and various other diseases.
Yeah.
So what will happen is they'll observe that relationship. And then some scientists will be like, okay, well, what is it about the Japanese diet that is so healthy? And then they'll think, oh, well, they eat lots of fish and there's lots of omega-3 fatty acids in fish. Mm-hmm. It must be the fish. That must be the omega-3 fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they will isolate the omega-3 fatty acid from fish.
Yeah.
And then they will put it into the diets of mice or rats or some other lab animal. Or they'll do some cell studies. And so they might find something interesting there, but at that point, it's so disconnected from the human and from diets and the overall pattern of diets that it's, well, we call it reductionism.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really make anything that we find in relation to an animal study or a cell study doesn't automatically, it can't automatically be extrapolated onto an entire population of people. And I think that's how the media tends to report it. So you'll think, you'll read the headlines like, you know, green tea burns fat or something ridiculous like that. And what's actually happened is that maybe, again, looking at the Japanese diet, Japanese people drink a lot of green tea. Let's isolate a compound from green tea and feed it like at super mega high doses to rats and see that it causes them to burn extra fat. But that reductionist sort of oversimplification of things doesn't necessarily apply to humans.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, it does. So you can, so obviously from that point of view, you can see that it's incredibly, you can understand why it's incredibly difficult, because obviously it's what's, works in humans isn't necessarily going to work in rats and so on.
Yeah, and we also eat entire diets, not just individual compounds. And we all have different genetics, we all have live in different environments, we have different stresses, we get different amounts of sleep. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all model, but like the media like to report it, and sometimes scientists like to study it as though we were living in some sort of bubble where you could control all these different variables, which is not real life.
Yeah. Wow, that's even, because I knew it was pretty convoluted, but that's even made me realise it's even more so. So kind of, well, maybe come back to that point in a minute, but kind of going back to your study, so you said that you, so that you ended up studying that, so you were doing biotechnology?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I was, and then I had this lecture on nutrition, and that was kind of towards the end of term, and I remember just going that summer and reading everything that I could about nutrition. And I mean, I was reading some weird stuff. Like, do you remember Patrick Holford? And
oh,
his, like,
yes. I've read a lot of Patrick Holford stuff. Yeah.
And you know, so, some of it is fair and credible, but there's a lot of sort of woo-woo to it.
Yeah.
and I'm not against woo-woo in general, but when it comes to nutritional science, I get pretty protective now. Mm-hmm. Then I didn't really know any better. And so I remember at the end, towards the end of that summer, and it was like the height of Gillian McKeith and all that crap.
Yes, I can remember that time well, because I think that was a point when I was, you know, doing all these different detoxes. This is just another form of diet for me, but all of that kind of stuff. So I can remember that period quite well.
Yeah, I remember being at a point that I was so scared to eat anything, and I would pretty much only eat salad and raw vegetables and like marinated tofu. Like, it was the most just weirdest diet. But then I wouldn't have anything else to eat in the house except salad, and I would always end up going out and getting a Dairy Milk. And I was like, what am I doing? I was going to say something there as well. It's got out of my head. Maybe it'll come back to me. But yeah, it was this super convoluted diet. And, you know, obviously the more that I learned about nutrition, I realized, wait, actually this isn't right. This doesn't make sense. This is not a balanced diet at all. But I still struggled with my relationship with food all the way through my PhD and even into my postdoc. I remember, because you have to bear in mind that the nutrition community, when you're in that sort of environment day in day out working in a nutrition department, everyone is very regimented with food and exercise and all that kind of thing, and you get swept away in it, you get really sucked up in it.
And
I remember doing things like the, not juice cleanse per se, but you know, you get like one of those sachets and you add
oh food.
So you have a smoothie and it's got like psyllium husk and a bunch of weird stuff in it. And then, so I was doing that, I was doing my Fitness Pal and counting calories, and of course I would get to the end of the day and I'd be, oh, well, I still have 200 calories left, and then I end up going way over and blowing it on, I don't know, half a jar of peanut butter or something like that. And then, you know, it got to the point where I was like, this is ridiculous, I'm really unhappy with the way that I'm essentially restricting and then binging and restricting and binging. I need to break this cycle. And I was really fortunate that I came across intuitive eating and health at every size around about that time.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was just like a light bulb went on for me, like, you know, cartoon style light bulb above my head. This makes so much sense. This makes way more sense than anything that I've been doing, but nobody told me about this in, you know, throughout my undergraduate or my PhD or my postdoc. And in fact, I remember a really prominent researcher at the university that I was doing my postdoc research at just like scoffing and turning her nose up at the concept of health at every size. And
just on the health at every size, just in case anyone's not familiar with it, can you kind of just tell us a little bit more about what that kind of concept is?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, how do I phrase this? So we live within what's referred to as a weight normative paradigm, meaning that we're taught that being smaller, being within a quote normal BMI is healthier, and it's healthiest, and we should all be trying to lose weight. Whereas health at every size, or what's known as a weight inclusive paradigm, it kind of posits that our weight is less under individual control than we're led to believe. And the things that we do have control over are things like, you know, the level of activity that we undertake, the number of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and things like that. That tends to have more of a bearing over our health than our actual weight does directly. I'm not sure if I explained that very well.
No, I think you did. And I mean, it's incredibly interesting. So if anyone is, because you recently, on Laura's podcast, Don't Start My Game, you recently interviewed Linda Bacon, who's the lead scientist around this kind of kind of concept.
Yeah, she can express it far more articulately than I can. But basically, it's the concept that, you know, some of these individual variables have far more influence over our health than our weight actually does. Mm-hmm. And also that our weight, we have a lot less control over our weight than we're kind of led to believe. You know, magazines and diet culture and all that kind of stuff will sort of say, it's so easy to lose weight, you know, just shed 10 pounds or just drink this milkshake and be skinny and happy and blah, 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 blah. But actually, it's a lot more difficult to change our weight than we're led to believe. And we have what's called a genetically determined set point weight. So basically, our genetics have a lot more to do with our weight than we're told. So again, I'm not sure if I explained that.
It's so incredibly interesting. I've really found, I mean, I kind of first learned a little bit about the idea of set point weight when I was going through hypothalamic amenorrhea when my period stopped. So it's really, really interesting to me. And I mean, if anyone wants to listen to Laura's podcast episode with Linda Bacon on health at every size, I'll put the link to that in the show notes for this episode so you'll be able to find it. But I definitely, to be honest, I think that's something that everyone should listen to, because it just blows the whole diet culture out of the water. They think that you know about diets and weight loss, it changes everything, really.
Something that I've found super encouraging is the number of nutritionists and dietitians who've listened to that episode and have had really positive feedback. And I think there's a shift coming in terms of people accepting this concept and sort of moving away from the dogma that we need to lose a bunch of weight in order to be healthy. And also the idea that, you know, that there aren't bigger socioeconomic forces at play that dictate our health outcomes more so than the sort of individual variables. I think, you know, everyone that you see on Instagram who's freaking out about losing weight is pretty much what I would consider to be the worried well, right? They're not the people who need to be thinking about reducing their sugar intake.
I could not agree with you more. And I mean, coming from, because my background's in community development, so I've done a lot of work with people. And I don't really know how to say this without being offensive and not wanting to be offensive, but I mean, I've worked in council estates, I've worked in highly deprived areas in Newcastle and Durham and some of the most deprived areas in the country. So I know exactly what you're talking about when you say that. It's not, you know, it's certainly not the people who are on Instagram that we need to be, that, you know, that we need to be concerned about. It's a whole other culture of another group of people who the messages just aren't getting through to, because first of all, they're just not relevant to them whatsoever. But there's a whole heap of other issues, I think, in terms of cost of food, availability, mental health issues, time. There's a whole lot of stuff. So it is really, really interesting when I think we put it in that, when we put weight within a different conversation, that it's not just about this thing that we can all control, and that if you're not controlling your weight, you're somehow lazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were saying that when you first brought this up with other nutritionists, they were scoffing at you.
Well, there was just one researcher in particular that and she was kind of, you know, someone who was probably fairly well established and had been trained within the dogma, as I was as well, in the dogma of, you know, lose weight, be healthier. And I think there's a sort of tide change now, but mm-hmm. it's going to take some time. And certainly, you know, not everyone that I bring this up with is receptive to it, you know, just the general public. And if I can sit down and sort of explain the damage that dieting can do and how that can screw up your metabolism, and weight cycling can screw up your metabolism, and mm-hmm. in the long run, lower your metabolism to the point where you actually need to eat even less calories to maintain your new lower, sort of artificially lower weight. I mean, that's super depressing to think about.
If you lost
a bunch of weight and, you know, you reach your goal weight, but actually now you can only eat sort of half or three quarters of the calories that you used to be able to eat. And so something that I do a lot with my clients is when I do their food diaries and analyze their food diaries, and I notice that, you know, they've been trying to lose weight, they're not losing weight, and I look at their diaries and I'm like, you're eating really few calories, you're mm-hmm. eating really few carbohydrates, and they're complaining that they don't have energy or anything, and I'm like, no shit, you don't have energy, you're not eating enough food to have any energy. But this idea of eating more and adding carbohydrates back into your diet in order to boost your metabolism a little bit and actually give you the energy that you need to live an active lifestyle is really terrifying for people, because we've been taught to believe that carbohydrates are so bad and they're going to make you fat and all this other rubbish. So there's like a lot of real talk that I have to have with clients around, you know, what's actually going on here when you restrict so much. You know, you're ruining your metabolism for one, but also you're ruining your relationship with food and the enjoyment that you get from food. So I think I'm waffling on a tangent over here.
No, don't, honestly, do not worry about it. I think I keep putting in and saying, well, tell me more about this, and can we talk more about that? But I think one of the reasons that I love you, Laura, is the fact that you've, as a someone who's got the, what's the right word, the clout in terms of you've got the education behind you and the qualifications behind you to be able to talk about this, and who's not just, and especially like on Instagram and podcasting, is not just another kind of, you know, do this crazy diet and lose weight and all that kind of stuff. I think it's really refreshing, and I think that this is where things are going, and obviously we've seen a lot of stuff coming out now about the whole concept of clean eating and this whole Instagram diet culture and stuff that's starting to come out. And I know that you would have a bitch fest about this as much as I do. You know what I mean? So I think it's really good that we are starting to have, you know, more people are having these kind of conversations where we are kind of looking at the whole idea of health at every size, and it's not just about kind of being this picture perfect, you know, frolicking on a beach doing like yoga handstands kind of bollocks, basically. So I'd love us to maybe talk a little bit more about intuitive eating, and I know you said there that how it kind of became part of your own journey, but what was kind of, I mean, was that the turning point for you then, discovering intuitive eating?
I think I discovered a woman named Kelsey Miller who writes for Refinery 29, she now has a memoir out called Big Girl, which is really excellent.
Yes, I've seen that. Yeah, I haven't read it. Yeah. Is it really good?
It's so good. I think everyone should read it, whether or not they're struggling with their weight or not. But it's a really fantastic book, and her resources on Refinery 29 are great, and I share them all the time with my intuitive eating group. And I think, you know, some of what she wrote about resonated with me, and around about the same time I came across the concept of health at every size, and I was just reading a lot of stuff, and then I started getting into the science of it a little bit more. I was really skeptical when I first came across it as most scientists are. Like I just told you about that one researcher who's just dead against it. But I think if she actually spent some time reading the literature and understanding it, you know, she could probably get behind it a lot more, because, you know, the current, what we do currently doesn't work. You know, diets don't work, weight loss rarely works, it doesn't work in the long term anyway, and it makes us pretty miserable and screws up our relationship with food. So so that was definitely a bit of a light bulb moment. And I think I was practicing elements of intuitive eating in my own life and in my nutrition practice, but not actually calling it that for a long time.
Yeah.
I think there was I was a little bit reluctant to sort of come out as, you know, as an intuitive eating person, because I really didn't know what kind of response I would have. But like I said, there are a number of people who are also on board with that message, you know, in terms of the nutrition community. So it, it's gone down fairly well. But yeah, then, you know, getting a hold of the Intuitive Eating book, really immersed myself in everything that I could related to intuitive eating. So listening to the interviews and reading articles by the authors, and really understanding what intuitive is, but also understanding its shortcomings and where the downfalls are, because it can be misused and turned into another diet.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you as well, because I know that you've said before that sometimes, you know, people will use the whole term perhaps intuitive eating or listening to your body and not really understand fully what that means or how to get to that point in a healthy way. And what kind of, you know, how have you seen that misused, and how do people tend to misuse it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been a whole thing, like you were talking about, the whole backlash and pushback against clean eating, is that it means that now people are scrambling to find another label for what they're doing, which I don't really understand, this need to label everything we do. And you know, I'm a this, I'm a that. But that's another conversation. Anyway, I've noticed that people are now gravitating towards either balance. Mm-hmm. And again, I feel like people are misusing the term balance. And I see a lot of people posting pictures of meals that are really, really restrictive in terms of carbohydrates, in terms of portion size. So to me, that's not balance. But anyway, the other thing that they're doing is saying, eat intuitively without any, let's just face it, they haven't read the book. They haven't read any of the literature. They don't understand that it's actually a very, rigid isn't the right word. It's, you know, there are steps. It's a process. It's something you actually have to go through and work on. It's not just something you do. And I think the best example I can give of this is, if you are someone who has constantly been on a diet, or if you're someone who has suffered from an eating disorder, your natural hunger and satiety cues have been so eroded over time that you don't actually know when you're hungry or when you're full. You have to really work on identifying what those mean to you. And, you know, I have a lot of people come to me and say, well, I don't know when I'm hungry, because they've only experienced being completely starving or completely stuffed, right? Like, there's no sort of spectrum in the middle. So part of intuitive eating is getting more towards the, okay, I'm a little bit hungry. What does it feel like to be a little bit hungry? And actually responding to hunger at the first signs of hunger, rather than when you're over hungry, because that's the point that you're more inclined to overeat or even binge. So does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the real interesting point there is, I think you're absolutely right, that people are saying intuitive eating, thinking that it's something that you just suddenly, oh, today I'm going to start listening to my body now. But it's a much more detailed process, especially if you have been so, you know, neck deep in diet mentality for several years, sometimes your whole life.
And I think it's just important to point out as well that saying listening to your body, again, can sound like complete crap, right? Like, you know, people, it's easy to take the piss out of people who say, oh, don't listen to your doctor, listen to your body, or something like that. But what I want to stress is that you know, I'm a scientist, and to me, this is biology, right? You're listening to your own biological hunger and satiety cues, which we were born with, mm-hmm. but which through the process of dieting or disordered eating, or just generally having a messed up relationship with food, have become eroded over time. And so it's about reconnecting with that, but it's also about finding the pleasure in food and unrestricting foods that you might have otherwise, completely removed from your diet because you were afraid that you were going to overeat them, or because you were afraid that you were addicted to them. And food addiction is actually something where there's very little literature around in terms of, to give you an example, think about the last time that you felt kind of crazy and out of control around a particular food. Let's mm-hmm. just say it was like brownies. Say you baked yourself some brownies and you ate half of the pan in a oneer. Mm-hmm. My question to you would be, okay, well, up until the point that you made this big pan of brownies and then ate half of them, were you restricting brownies, or were you allowing brownies in your diet every
yeah.
day?
Yeah.
And the chances are that you were probably severely restricting brownies, so that the next time you encountered them, of course you were going to feel out of control around them because you're hardwired to want the thing that's off limits.
Yeah. I think it's when people put that scarcity around something as well, that they think that, mm-hmm. well, I can only have brownies today, therefore I'm going to have every goddamn brownie because I'm never going to be able to have them again. And that's the all or nothing diet mentality, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then they feel so bad, they feel so guilty about yeah. having the brownies, that they then restrict and restrict and restrict again until the point where they end up overeating and binging on them, rather yeah. than having a more balanced approach to it and just allowing yourself to have what you want when you want it, and then prevent this overeating in yeah. the long term.
I think a big element, or certainly from the way that I tend to look at this, is around trust in themselves. Mm-hmm. And I know that was something that I struggled with when I was kind of, because I would consider that now I eat quite intuitively, and it's taken me very, very, very many years to get to that point. But I think it's about trusting that you're not going to, that eventually things are going to settle, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. Do mm-hmm. you find that there's a trust element in terms of trust within yourself, that you're going to be able to find that balance within yourself, or is it more acceptance that you're not going to be perfect at the same time?
I think it's both of those things, but I think it's also a lot of fear as well. And I think that they're related, and it's hard to sort of say where yeah. one stops and the next begins. But yeah, there's a fear that you're going to be out of control around food, that when you give yourself permission to eat what you'd like to eat, that you'll never be able to stop eating. And there's, you know, that element of food addiction as well. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, part of conquering that fear, I think, is building up trust with yourself and around food, and trusting yourself that you can be around food and you're not going to sort of eat everything under the sun. Mm-hmm. So part of what we're doing in my intuitive eating course, and it's just part of the process of intuitive eating, is writing out a list of everything that you like to eat. So everything from, I don't know, ripe peaches in the height of summer, all the way through to like bag of Maltesers, I don't know. And making sure, and then going through and then circling everything that you restrict that's on that list. So identifying the things that you both like to eat and that you are preventing yourself from eating, or you're not giving yourself permission to eat. And then going through the process of one by one giving yourself permission to eat that particular food, and then having it in the house, stocking it up, making sure it's always available, more than you could ever possibly eat in one go.
Yeah.
And then go through the process of what's called habituation of food. So that's where you just get bored of food, essentially. It mm-hmm. starts to lose its appeal because you've had it unrestricted, you've had as much.
It loses its power, doesn't it? It loses that kind of that whole naughty thing, that whole thing that is bad, exactly. because it's just there.
Yes, exactly. And so you almost have to go through that process of kind of overdoing it a little bit mm-hmm. to realize that actually that food isn't that interesting to me. And the only reason that I cared so much about it was because I couldn't have it. And then once you go through this process and you check off a couple of the food items on your list, you slowly start to learn to trust that food isn't all that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be okay around it. But you kind of have to go through this process of giving yourself permission and allowing yourself to have as much of it. Only then can you rebuild this trust that you're talking about with yourself and around foods.
Yeah.
So hopefully I explained that.
No, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, it's really good. And I mean, now is a probably good time to mention as well. So you run an intuitive eating course, and I think you said that it's going to be opened up again in March. Is that right?
Yeah, towards the end of March, I'll be opening it up again for registration. And it's a 10-week program. And I just have to caveat this with, there's absolutely no way that you will become an intuitive eater in 10 weeks. But once you buy into the course, you have unlimited access to all the materials. So even if I post new things or post stuff in the Facebook mm-hmm. group, then you'll always have access to that. So it's about, you know, learning those initial skills and then, you know, carrying that with you as you hopefully move towards becoming more of an intuitive eater, but certainly don't expect it to happen in 10 weeks.
and where can people find out about that course?
So it's on my website, which is laurathomasphd.co.uk/intuitive, I think. And I think the best part about this course, I think, is you know, a lot of people have read the intuitive eating book and they understand the concepts, but it's having someone to push them to actually
implement.
people need
accountability. I think that's one thing that we've learned, and I think having a course and having that guidance there, I think it takes it from reading a book about it to actually implementing that stuff and making it happen in your life.
Yeah, and not only that, but having a community of people who are going through it at the same time that you can kind of vent to. Oh, this woman at work was going on and on about her diet and I just can't take it anymore. You know, like that kind of stuff. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. But also sharing articles and resources that people come across that are helpful and interesting, and podcasts and all that kind of stuff. So I think the community element of it is really important as well.
Yeah, brilliant. So if you want to know more about intuitive eating, that is the place to go. If you're listening, and you said as well that there's a book, is that book just called Intuitive Eating?
Yeah, it's called Intuitive Eating, and I can never pronounce the name of the authors, but I'll send you the link so that you can.
Thank you. We'll add that to the show notes. That'd be brilliant.
Yeah,
that's fab. So, in terms of kind of for people who might be listening who kind of feel like this is something that they might want to get started with, I mean, in terms of, you know, tips for them to go ahead with things and to move on, would it be, you know, reading the book as a first step?
Yeah, I think so. I think the book really gives you a good foundation in all of these concepts. But, you know, the first principle mm-hmm. of intuitive eating is to reject the diet mentality.
Yeah.
So what this means is kind of acknowledging when things are trying to sell you a diet. And what I mean by that is, well, the best example is clean eating, really. You know, on the surface, everyone was like, oh, it's all about health, it's all about being well. But if you just kind of scratch under the surface a little bit, you'll start to see that it's about controlling your diet, it's about controlling the food, it's about being afraid of food. And, you know, if you're always sort of tethered to that, you'll never be able to eat intuitively. So I encourage people to unfollow accounts online that are promoting
me too
weird diets. Delete things like MyFitnessPal, get rid of like Jawbones and calorie tracking apps, because again it just all keeps you tethered to the diet mentality. Rid of like cookbooks written by people like Joe Wicks, for example, because it's all, you know.
Sorry, I'm having to have to laugh at that one.
Well, because it's just, it's so restrictive, and
he's a clown.
He doesn't know anything about nutrition, and you know, just any of those, like we were talking before about like Madeline Shaw, or any of these kinds of books. You know, if you genuinely like their recipes, then great, but don't be tricked into thinking that you know, you should eat like them, because you're never going to look like them.
I think that's the whole. I mean, that's always been my issue with that kind of thing is that it's, you know, it's healthy and happy has just become another way of saying like thin.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. And it's all about aesthetics. And just to give you another example of something that really, really annoyed me lately was on the front cover of Women's Health magazine, a magazine that claims to be about caring about women's health. And there was one of the headlines on the front cover was something along the lines of how muscles became the new sexy. Yeah. So just to give you an idea of how entrenched in diet mentality that is, and how it's not really obvious at first. So there's the whole idea of strong, not skinny, mm-hmm. which again, on the surface, sounds great. But if you sort of start peeling back the layers a little bit, what this Women's Health article was talking about is, well, if we first of all accept the fact that we all have muscles, like it's kind of a prerequisite for being a human being is that you have muscles. What it's actually saying is that in order to be sexy, in order to be validated, you have to have muscles that are visible and that are big. And in order to do that, you need to seriously cut back on the number of calories you're eating, you need to hit the gym every day for 2-3 hours a day, and you need to drop your body fat percentage so low that you're going to be miserable, potentially amenorrheic, have all kinds of problems. So you can see what on the surface sounds like an innocuous message is actually telling you that you have to lose weight and you have to change everything about your body in order to be sexy.
Yeah.
Like what the fuck? Sorry, yeah. I don't know if I'm
No, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. Yeah, no, absolutely. If anything deserves a what the fuck, that does, definitely. I think that's a really good point as well. I think about avoiding magazines like that. And to be honest, I don't think there's any women's magazines nowadays. I mean, the only magazines I read are things like The Simple Things and All Comely, things that have got like no diet kind of stuff in at all, because it's so entrenched in those things. And again, it's everywhere on social media as well. And I think like what you said, being aware of that and then being able to cut that out of your life, mm-hmm. is just really, really important, isn't it, about, you know, kind of getting, yeah. those things out,
because you can never really be an intuitive eater if you're tethered to diet culture.
Yeah. And I mean, you gave a really good example then. I think it's, I mean, is there anything else that people would perhaps look for in terms of, you know, there's lots of things that kind of get mentioned, I think, and that sound quite innocent on the surface, but, you know, in terms of how to eat and what to eat and things like that. Is it anything that tries to kind of be really descriptive about what to eat? Is that something that should be, you know, giving you a red flag, or how would you kind of view that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially the thing that has been kind of annoying me lately is the whole fitness blogger phenomenon, and mm-hmm. fitness bloggers trying to give nutrition information when mm-hmm. they're not really qualified to, and they have a really skewed idea of what balance is. They eat very, very high protein meals, very restrictive and very low in carbohydrates. And what I would just say about that is that if you're restricting carbohydrates very low, what happens is basically your blood sugar level can get quite low. You might have experienced this if you've been working out and you haven't eaten. So you skip breakfast or something because you're doing a workout, or you don't really refuel properly after your workout. And then you, basically what happens is it sends out something called neuropeptide Y, which is I'm not even going to try and say it anymore because I can't get it out. But basically, it's a neurotransmitter that essentially sends a signal saying food is scarce. We must go and try and eat anything that is high in carbs, high in fat, high in salt and sugar, those types of foods. Mm-hmm. And so this is something you're hardwired to do. This is what your biology is telling you to do. So what ends up happening is you overeat and you binge later in the day, because you've been restricting throughout the day. So there's actually like a biological mechanism. There's actually a few biological mechanisms that trigger this sort of binging behavior. Yeah. But one of the biggest things that, and I see this in my practice all the time, is that people are following very restrictive low carbohydrate diets. So, you know, basically not eating enough carbohydrates, is triggering binging and overeating. Yeah. So I would also say that, you know, you don't want to just be eating white toast all the time. There's nothing wrong with white bread, but you don't want to eat that all the time. So think about, like, how can I get more carbohydrates into my diet that are maybe going to be a bit more substantial or going to sustain me for a longer period of time? So, you know, different beans and pulses, different fruits and vegetables, whole grains especially. So, yeah, don't restrict. Just, if anything, eat more carbohydrates and get a good wide variety of whole grains in.
Yeah. Fantastic. So that's been really helpful, I think. And like we said before, if anyone's interested in a little bit more on the intuitive eating kind of program that Laura runs, you can check that out at her website. I think that was laurathomasphd.co.uk/intuitive, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fab. We'll put that link anyway in the show notes. But yeah, I could probably talk to you all day.
No, right?
To be honest about all of this stuff. So perhaps we'll have to get you back on in the future episode. But thank you so much for talking with us. It's been really, really interesting. I've personally really enjoyed finding out a little bit more about your story from listening to you doing lots of interviews. It's nice for me to be able to kind of find out a bit more about you and what your journey's been personally as well. So thank you very much for that. And I'm sure that a lot of our listeners have found that really, really interesting. And I think the health at any size, you know, kind of concept and how that links in with body positivity, which I know you're a big, you know, follower of and a big advocate for, is definitely the way forward as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it is. But again, be very cautious of, I know you're aware of this, Laura, but to the listeners, be cautious of anything that is sort of pseudo body positive. And again, things like your Women's Health magazine or sometimes even I've noticed this a lot with clothing lines who are, you know, promoting that they go up to, like, I don't know, a size 14 or a size 16.
Oh, well, my God.
You know,
yeah.
that's only, you know, that's stopping a certain proportion of a certain proportion of the population. So
yeah, I mean, there's some really good people. So just to quickly end the podcast with this, but I know that you introduced me to Megan Crabb, who was Body Positive Panda on Instagram, and I'll put a link to that podcast that you did with her as well. But I know that she and other body positive Instagrammers are very, very good at calling out companies who are saying that they're body positive when they're actually not. Because I think in some ways, as ridiculous as it is, sometimes it's hard for people to get their heads around, you know, body positive is not, it's actually got nothing to do with health. It's totally irrelevant of someone's health. It's about being completely, it's the fact that, you know, you're allowed to exist in whatever body you want to exist in.
And you should be respected
and
given the same opportunities as anybody else, regardless of the size of the body that you live in. You know, and you're right, Laura, like, it's, health might be important to you and me because it's kind of the field that we're working in, but that doesn't mean to say it's everybody's priority. Like, they have other stuff going on in their lives that they need to take care of, you know. So maybe they haven't got around to health, or maybe they don't really give a shit.
I don't know. And that's their prerogative, isn't it?
That's their business. Yeah, that's not my business. But it's also not my business to look at a person and say and judge them on purely on the basis of their weight. Like, weight is not an indication of health necessarily.
Yeah.
So,
and that's a good way to finish the podcast. Weight is not an indication of health.
We can go on forever, but yeah, thank you so much, Laura, for having me on. It's really nice and also weird to be on another podcast.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's been fantastic. And just to finish off, again, if you've enjoyed this episode, we'd absolutely love for you to share it. And also, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. Kezia and I would be so grateful if you could do that. So yes, thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.